This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with author Marjorie Hines about her new book on academic freedom.
At one time in this country, teachers were fired for all kinds of reasons. Communists, subversives, etc. This book, Priests of Our Democracy, The Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and the Anti-Communist Purge, puts it into a political context that is utterly fascinating.
We'll hear about yet another attempt from the Vatican to deflect attention from the scandal of sexual abuse.
The evidence points more and more to the Pope and the Council for the Propagation of the Faith. Hear why.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, I remember years ago when we named college football stadiums and other public arenas after coaches, baseball players, individuals who we wanted to memorialize. Now the shift is to name stadiums after corporations, often multinational ones, and in my opinion, they become permanent institutionalized advertisements for these companies.
Yeah, well, the most ludicrous one is the KFC Yum Stadium, but they've taken it one step further. Instead of naming it after a fried chicken, the Florida Atlantic University, it's hard to say this, Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton, Florida, just named its stadium after a private for-profit prison corporation named the GEO Corporation. The GEO Corporation made $1.6 billion last year. It owns and runs prisons around the planet. It incarcerates everybody from felons to people they deem illegal immigrants. They have currently 73,000 beds for prisoners. In order to promote their good name, they gave $6 million to Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton, Florida, to name the athletic stadium there the GEO Stadium. So now we have a new take on the school-to-prison pipeline. We now have the prison-to-school pipeline. Priests of Our Democracy, The Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and the Anti-Communist Purge is the title of a recently published excellent book by attorney Marjorie Hines, a First Amendment lawyer who sometimes collaborates with the Center for Constitutional Rights. The book examines not only the very dark period in academic freedom within New York City in the 50s and the 60s, but goes all the way back to the first great academic freedom cases originating at the University of Wisconsin, and all the way up to the current situation with the laws that repress professors and students with respect to the events after 9/11. Author Marjorie Hines shows historically that academic freedom, never taken for granted, it always has to be fought for. We're joined today by Marjorie Hines, civil liberties lawyer, writer, teacher, and the founding director of the Free Expression Policy Projects. Marjorie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. My pleasure.
It's just a terrific book. And I have to say that I went to the University of Wisconsin, and your first chapter is called Sifting and Winnowing, and it's about one of the heroes from the University of Wisconsin back in the 1890s, which was one of the first great academic freedom fights. And I wanted you to talk about Professor Richard Ely and what happened there, and then let's talk about that plaque they've got on the wall.
Okay. Well, Ely was one of a generation in the very late 19th century of experts in the new field of social science. He was an economist. He had quite a following. He was also a kind of leftist, a Christian socialist, and very involved in trying to support the burgeoning labor movement. And he gets attacked by one of the right-wingers on the state board of regents, essentially, and charged with having some inappropriate advocacy outside of the classroom. In support of a strike that was going on. Turned out he wasn't even guilty of that, and from today's point of view, we would think, so what if he was? but he's brought up on charges, and there is, for the first time really, this has not been the first incident, but there is a lot of agitation at this point. Boards of trustees, which are dominated by corporate executives, do not like these new scholars in the fields of social science who are also activists. Scott Nearing at Pennsylvania was another example somewhat later. So it's really a political, an attempt at a political purge against this really national figure, really. And what happens is the burgeoning forces of academic freedom sort of rally around him. They see the danger. And ultimately, he's vindicated in an opinion by an investigatory committee that has this famous language.
Marjorie, would you mind reading that for us? It's only a couple sentences, and it really is moving.
If I can find it in the book.
It's on the bottom of page 19.
Oh, thank you. Okay, the report of the investigative committee's rhetorical climax was a sentence that 16 years later was reproduced on a plaque that sits at the entrance to the university's main administration building. Quote, "We believe that the great state University of Wisconsin should ever encourage that continual and fearless sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth can be found." And maybe the sifting and winnowing metaphor was a reflection of the Midwestern origin of this, but Wisconsin became really the first university to announce this principle.
Ely hired a professor named Ross, and Ross did some terrific things in terms of labor rights, child labor. Talk about the relationship between academic freedom and free speech and good reforms.
Well, in those early days, the main attacks on the activist professors really were on activities outside the classroom in support of labor organizing. And Ross had a famous encounter with the one-person board of trustees at Stanford University, the widow of Leland Stanford, who forced him out because of his support of labor organizing and other left liberal activities in the San Francisco Bay Area. He ends up at University of Wisconsin, where he gets into some trouble for inviting Emma Goldman to have a tour of the campus, but he remains at Wisconsin. Then, as I mentioned, Scott Nearing is at Pennsylvania, and he's been involved in a fight to ban child labor in the state. And as a result of that, he is fired summarily, and he organizes quite an extensive and successful publicity campaign, and there's a lot of a debate nationwide about academic freedom. This is 1915. He doesn't get his job back, but as a result of really the Nearing case and the kind of escalating importance of the issue, a bunch of professors get together from around the country and start the AAUP, the American Association of University Professors, and they, for the first time, articulate, they issue a declaration of principles on academic freedom, and they basically identified three elements of it. One is freedom in your classroom within limits, obviously. It's a kind of cautious statement. The second is freedom in your research and scholarship to pursue learning where it may lead, which sometimes means overturning conventional wisdom. And the third is what they called extramural speech, outside the walls. And that was the political activism, which was really the main target of repression of academics in that period. But gradually, the other two elements of academic freedom, especially in the period that I focus on in the book, the so-called McCarthy era, 1950s, it's really a combination of attacking teachers and professors as well as people in all other phases of professional life, not only because of their perhaps membership in the Communist Party, signing of a petition, participation in a labor or civil rights organization in the 30s, but also the accusation that we have to get all these leftists out of the school system because they're going to indoctrinate the tender minds of our youth with Marxist ideas. It was not an accusation that was true. In fact, when you start looking at what happened in this period, it is the boards of education and the legislative investigating committees like the House Un-American Activities Committee which are trying to get rid of any kind of balanced or even-handed treatment of political issues in the classroom, literary issues in the classroom for that matter, and trying to impose a kind of indoctrination of America first and the Soviet Union is the evil empire and that kind of very good and evil kind of thinking. Essentially, they were trying to impose indoctrination.
Marjorie, I noticed that an individual named Harry Kishin, a fellow Armenian, plays a prominent role in the development of academic freedom. Can you elaborate on that?
Okay. Well, Harry Kayashian starts the book, and he's one of the wonderful characters I discovered as I was working on it. You know, the Kayashian versus Board of Regents case is 1967 Supreme Court case is famous among First Amendment lawyers because it basically reverses a lot of prior, earlier, not-so-good decisions which upheld loyalty programs, and the Kayashian decision strikes down the so-called Feinberg Law, which had been passed in 1949 and upheld by the Supreme Court a couple of years later. Feinberg Law creates a very sweeping program of loyalty investigations for teachers in the public schools, eventually professors and other staff in the public colleges are added, other public employees as well. Kayashian is a student in 1952, really at the height of the witch hunt period at Queens College in New York City, when the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee comes to town. And they are interested in pressuring the Board of Higher Education, which is the agency that administers the four free public colleges in New York City, Queens, Brooklyn, City College, and Hunter. They're interested in pressuring them into doing the kind of really intensive loyalty interrogations and investigations that had been going on at the Board of Education, which administered the K through 12 system for several years, even before the Feinberg Law gets passed and puts all this, makes all this a legal obligation throughout the state. And the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee starts summoning teachers at the city colleges. And one of the first people who was summoned to testify is a professor that Harry had, economics professor, labor historian named Vera Schlachman.
She's a really extraordinary professor, and they did her in.
They did her in. She was a leftist. She was really a pioneer of labor history at a time when the traditional, to the extent labor history was taught in high schools and colleges, it was... It understated the issue of class conflict. And she writes a book as a young scholar about a company town in Chicopee, Massachusetts. It's really a study of the working people and the conflicts that they had with the boss. She is hired by Queens College, and she is a very much beloved teacher. She was probably called by the Senate Internal Security Subcommittee because she was an officer in the teachers' union. And the teachers' union, which at that time represented both teachers at the K-12 level and teachers at the colleges, was a radical union, and it was really remarkably fighting union. It fought for an end to discrimination against minority schools, which were in appallingly bad shape, tried to get rid of really shocking racism in textbooks. And the teachers' union was a thorn in the side of the Board of Education for many years. And once the Cold War anti-communist investigations begin, it's a wonderful excuse for the Board of Education in New York to really try to wipe out the teachers' union, get rid of the teachers who are its leaders. So that's probably why she gets subpoenaed. And she refuses to answer questions about her political beliefs, her political associations or activities, and takes a position which a number of professors before and after had taken, that the proper criteria for a teaching position is your competence as a scholar and a teacher. And nobody was accusing her or any of the others, really, of any specific incompetence. So at this point in the history of the anti-communist investigations, taking that position before a congressional committee and basically arguing that you have a First Amendment right to your political opinions and not to be interrogated by a government agency which is clearly out to expose and stigmatize people and drive them out of their jobs, that First Amendment argument had been rejected by the courts. If that was what you relied on, you would go to jail for contempt of Congress, as the Hollywood Ten had and other witnesses before these committees who resisted these interrogations. So in addition to the First Amendment, she cites the Fifth Amendment, protecting citizens against being forced to testify against themselves. But in those days, you were considered a Fifth Amendment communist if you did that. It was considered the equivalent of a confession of guilt. And she is the first of almost 20 people in the city college system who are summarily fired, tenured professors, who some of them much beloved. Her colleague Oscar Schaftel at Queens was another one, and he's very feisty. You know, he tells the committee when he's called to testify, a communist can be a competent teacher. Would you tell Pablo Picasso that he was not qualified to teach art? And he gives other examples. He sort of shames the committee by telling them, you're making us the laughingstock of Europe. And it's just obscene, essentially, to see college administrators running around scared like Keystone Cops, he said, worried that one of these investigating headline hunting committees is going to come and start interrogating the faculty. So they all lose their jobs, and Harry Kayishian, who had been quite apolitical before that point, as he told me, he was more interested in girls than politics, he's politicized by this, and eventually he becomes a English instructor at the University of Buffalo just about a year after the university, which had been private, gets taken over by the state university system, becomes part of SUNY, State University of New York. And they are now all subject to this Feinberg Law, which requires investigations into the political beliefs of everybody who's employed in the state civil service, colleges, public schools. And by this point, the trustees of the SUNY system have decided, well, this is quite a burdensome undertaking to start looking into. And some of these investigations were very broad. What books people read, what magazines they subscribed to, what concerts they went to. Did you have Paul Robeson records in your home? Did you march in a May Day parade? Did you vote for the American Labor Party, which was a left liberal party at the time? Did you vote for the Progressive Party? Heaven forbid. So this is quite a burdensome thing to be asking the administrations of all the state colleges to do. So instead, the Board of Trustees decides to make everybody sign a Feinberg certificate, as it was called, which was basically a loyalty oath, which said, I understand all the provisions of the Feinberg Law, and I have never said or done anything seditious or treasonous, and I don't believe in the overthrow of the government, and I've never been a member of the Communist Party, and if I was, I've told the president all about it. So Kayishian is one of the faculty is outraged by this, but it's a condition of keeping their jobs. And so after a lot of sturm and drang, they basically, everybody pretty much signs this thing, except for Kayishian and four others who refuse. He loses his job. Another one of the five resistors was the poet George Starbuck. He loses his job. And they bring a lawsuit to challenge the Feinberg Law, which has been upheld a decade earlier. And so nobody's very optimistic about this lawsuit. But they have this conviction that it's now the mid-60s and the courts are not going to let people who are perfectly competent and have not been accused of any subversive activities just be fired because of refusal, conscientious refusal to sign this oath. They lose in the lower courts, and it's a long struggle, but eventually they get to the Supreme Court, and it's now 1966. The decision comes out in January of 60.
We're speaking with attorney Marjorie Haynes. Marjorie wrote Priests of Our Democracy. It's a very good book. It just came out. I urge everybody to get it and read it. Priests of Our Democracy, H-E-I-N-S, Marjorie Haynes. And tell us about this major victory, because I think that in retrospect cleared the way for a lot of hundreds of teachers in the New York system that had been fired earlier. But tell us about Harry's victory.
Well, what had happened is my book sort of weaves between the stories of these individuals and what's going on behind the scenes at the Supreme Court. So up until the Kayishian case, first you have the Vinson Court in the late 40s, early 50s, Chief Justice Fred Vinson. They are pretty much making a shambles of the old First Amendment clear and present danger test, and they are upholding virtually every kind of loyalty oath and investigation that is challenged. Earl Warren comes in 53, and there is a gradual change in the personnel of the court and a gradual change in the political atmosphere. There is certainly, by the late 50s, there is beginning to be a real reaction against the excesses of McCarthyism and what the damage that has been done to people and to the whole political system, both on campuses and elsewhere. So gradually, little by little, and it's very much a story in the late 50s, early 60s of one step forward by the Supreme Court and a step back, because they will strike down a loyalty oath or they will impose some limits on a House Un-American Activities Committee investigation. There will be reaction, there will be criticism, people in Congress will start jumping up and down and demanding that Earl Warren be impeached or that laws be passed restricting the Supreme Court's jurisdiction. But little by little, they are chipping away at the loyalty programs and loyalty oaths. But it's not until the Kishin case in 67 that the Supreme Court really comes out and says this whole system of loyalty investigations violates the First Amendment and the due process provisions of the Constitution. The standards are much too vague. The sweep is much too broad. It impinges on legitimate free expression. It turns on guilt by association. You remember the Communist Party? You may have joined for completely innocent reasons. It was a legal party. You may have been working on only the legal activities of the party, and the fact that various state and federal agencies have determined that the Communist Party also had illegal aims to have a revolution at some point in the future is not enough to condemn somebody and to have them lose their job. And because the plaintiffs in this case are professors, Justice Brennan goes on in the Kishin case to talk about academic freedom. And he says it's a special concern of the First Amendment, which doesn't tolerate laws that cast a pall of orthodoxy over the classroom. So even though the Feinberg Law was mostly targeting teachers and professors' extracurricular activities, Brennan is recognizing that this kind of law is also going to have a profound effect and had a profound effect on the whole atmosphere in schools and colleges.
Marjorie, many of the themes during that time resonate today. Can you talk generally about the state of academic freedom now amidst concerns about national security by our government, and how does that inform some of the things we've seen recently?
Well, I talk about this toward the end of the book. I sort of trace the history of academic freedom both in and out of the courts in the years since the Kishin case, now almost 50 years ago. And there are some comparisons that are worth noting. And one is the way in which the term terrorism, which is a very scary word, has come to replace the term communism. It's thrown around quite loosely, and it can mean a lot of different things. So we may all have a concept of what we think terrorism is, but when we look at, for example, the way in which the federal government, the Secretary of State, compiles the list of foreign terrorist organizations and all the consequences that flow from being listed, we see that the determination is very political. It's based on the political, foreign policy, and economic interests of the United States. So, of course, the famous example is the African National Congress for decades was on the terrorist list. And if the laws we have today criminalizing, quote-unquote, material support for an organization that's been listed as a terrorist organization, if those laws had been in effect in the 1980s, people who provided any sort of assistance, not even financial assistance, but working with the African National Congress, for example, to submit a petition to the United Nations, they would be criminals. That was criminal. That has been criminalized. That kind of activity has now been criminalized, so that in a case that the Supreme Court decided in 2010, people in the United States who wanted to assist the Kurdistan Workers' Party, group that has been around in Turkey defending the rights of the Kurds for a long time, to assist them with peaceful, nonviolent dispute resolution, like filing petitions with the United Nations, were prohibited from doing so. And they filed this lawsuit, First Amendment lawsuit. And the Supreme Court actually recognizes that this material support law is so broad that it does infringe on First Amendment rights. But then Chief Justice Roberts writes this opinion, and he turns around and says, okay, it infringes on First Amendment rights. We have to give it very searching scrutiny to see if there's a justification. But then he just doesn't really do any kind of searching scrutiny and buys into these national security arguments will basically defer to the executive branch of government to decide what kind of restrictions are needed to further American foreign policy, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. Marjorie, let's fast forward to recent events in Brooklyn. You call your book Priests of Our Democracy. How would you apply that to the professors in the political science department out in Brooklyn talk about BDS and the Palestine Solidarity Movement?
Well, actually, I believe it was the students, student groups that invited two advocates of boycotting Israel in protest of its policies in the occupied territories. And part of the controversy arose because the political science department, quote-unquote, co-sponsored this event, which doesn't really mean very much. But and I think the people who objected to it and ultimately threatened Brooklyn College with reducing its funding if they didn't cancel this event, I don't think the fact that the political science department co-sponsored it was really an important factor. They were able to use that. But Priests of Our Democracy is actually, it refers to teachers. It's a quote from a Supreme Court decision by Felix Frankfurter in which he says, Priests of Our Democracy, teachers are priests of our democracy. And it's a little bit of an over-the-top metaphor, but the point is it's their job to instill habits of open-mindedness and critical inquiry, which alone make for responsible citizens. So it's a notion that education, especially higher education, but he's talking about all education, is not just about rote learning or being indoctrinated with one point of view. It's a process of opening minds and teaching critical thinking skills so that people can make intelligent decisions as citizens. That is sort of an underlying principle of academic freedom. So you have these pressures being brought to bear on Brooklyn College not to sponsor this event. The argument is it's one-sided. Brooklyn College resists, and to her credit, the president of the college says, you know, we've had speakers representing all points of view on this issue, this very highly charged issue of Israel and Palestine and many other issues. Alan Dershowitz, who was one of the people leading the charge on attacking the college for this event, has been invited to speak, and he's never requested, and nobody's ever suggested there has to be somebody there to articulate a contrary point of view. The idea is that part of academic freedom, indeed, is the ability to invite speakers over a broad range of opinions onto campus so that the students will be exposed to lots of different ideas. And these demands for quote-unquote balance are really often an attempt either to silence or to impose a viewpoint which either the professoriate may not consider to be intellectually worthy. If you had a program on the Holocaust, do you have to invite a Holocaust denier? I mean, not every point of view is worthy of being heard in a university setting. And it's the people who are expert in the field who need to be the ones who make those decisions. So although balance sounds good in principle, these demands for balance that not only were made in the Brooklyn College situation, but in the period just after 9/11, when there were a lot of attacks on teach-ins and Middle East scholars were attempting to give some context and some understanding of the hatred of the United States and in other parts of the world, these demands for balance are often demands to impose on the university's autonomy and the professor's ability to make judgments about what's worthy of study in the field.
Attorney Marjorie Hines has written a very, very good book, Priests of Our Democracy, The Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and the Anti-Communist Purge. And we thank you so much for your efforts, and we thank you for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yeah,
thanks,
good luck.
Thanks, Marjorie.
Good luck.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thank you.
Vatican revised its internal procedures for purportedly making it easier to discipline sex abuser priests. Critics of the revisions claim that the Vatican merely tweaked the process and still fail to hold bishops accountable for abuse by priests on their watch. The revisions also fail to require the reporting of sexual abuse to the authorities. To talk more about this, we're joined today by Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Pam Spees. On the telephone, we're joined by Barbara Blaine, founder of SNAP, Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. SNAP is the nation's oldest and largest self-help organizations for victims of clergy sexual abuse. Welcome, Barbara and Pam, to Law and Disorder.
Well, thanks for having me.
And Pam, welcome yourself to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Barbara, before we get started with the specifics about the new Vatican rules, can you tell us what SNAP is and your involvement?
Well, SNAP is a now worldwide movement of survivors, and my involvement is that I actually started SNAP and am the president. We are survivor-based, and we invite supporters to join us, and we have approximately 10,000 members. The vast majority are from the United States, but we do have members from across the globe.
So that you have 10,000 members, and most of those people are survivors?
Yes. Some are spouses or family members, but most are survivors.
And survivors of what exactly?
Survivors of sexual abuse by priests or other clergy members, sometimes by religious brothers, by nuns, by deacons, even bishops.
When did you form?
We actually started SNAP back in 1988. We grew in 2002 and 2003 as the headlines across the United States were exploding with stories of abuse by priests.
And tell me a little bit about what people have been able to do in the organization. I mean, there's everything from psychological counseling to complaints about the priests to getting prosecutions. I mean, I'm sure there's many different things that have gone on. Court cases, settlements. Can you give us some overall picture of what it looks like right now?
Sure. We're basically a survivor-based movement, and we don't hold out that we are experts. We are the survivors. What we model ourselves using a self-help model. We try to learn all we can about the impact of the abuse upon us and how to prevent others from being abused the way we were. And so what happens is that in day-to-day life, we have support group meetings, like in the United States, probably in about 65 different cities. And those meetings are usually held monthly, and in some places more or less, depending on their situation. And then we also have a website where we provide information, and we do what we call kind of like peer counseling. And mostly we encourage each other to do what we have to do to protect ourselves, to find healing for ourselves. And then one of the things we've learned over time, because obviously we didn't know at the beginning, you know, 20 years ago, what we know today. And we were extremely naive, not to mention wounded, and just trying to figure out how to make it from day to day. But one of the big things we learned is that while we cannot go back and reclaim our innocence, we can't go back to being 12 or 13 years old again, but it's empowering and healing for us if we can be involved in protecting someone else who's 12 or 13 today or even in the future, to protect them from being abused.
A lot of allegations have come out about individual priests, about parishes, the Pope, the Vatican, et cetera. And, of course, that's what really brought it to public attention of not just your interviewers here, but worldwide and certainly all over this country. So we had a huge splash of press, you know, daily almost. And I think one of the reasons we felt it was important particularly to talk to you now is because we don't see that anymore. And yet, of course, from what I know, a lot of the issues haven't been resolved. So you can give us some sense of what's going on now with regard to the Vatican, the Pope, if there's cases where they are there changes in the rules which we read about, just some sense of that. And then we'll bring Pam into the conversation because that's when sort of Pam started getting involved with SNAP.
Well, I think what's happened is that some documents were released starting in 2009 in Ireland, and those were the results of government investigations into the allegations of priests and other religious figures sexually abusing children. as these results of these investigations were made public, people were shocked, but victims found themselves empowered and recognized that they weren't alone, which gave many the courage to speak up and report their own abuse. So then what happened is that victims across Europe, you know, in Germany and in Belgium and Austria and Netherlands and England and all over Europe just started speaking out and reporting their abuse, and one thing led to another. And eventually in Ireland, at the end of 2009, four bishops were resigning their positions, and the Pope has issued statements and, you know, supposedly adopted a new policy. From our perspective, what comes out of the Vatican is a lot of lofty words and empty promises. If you look for concrete action, you'll see very, very little, if any.
Pam, you're an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and you've been working with Barbara in some capacity. Why don't you tell us how that began and what your thinking is now on these issues?
We joined a conversation with SNAP about looking for ways of to ensure accountability for what's going on. I mean, one of the things that's been happening is that the civil cases brought in the U.S. have yielded a lot of information and a lot of the documents that are now informing, you know, what we know about the scope, you know, or a systemic problem within the church that allowed for this stuff to continue happening and actually fostered it on such a widespread scale. And so it's one thing to fight it in individual cases. It's another to how do you get, is there a legal framework that gets at the widespread nature of this? We're talking about massive numbers of victims for years. I mean, there's one book out that discusses the 2,000-year-old paper trail of sexual abuse in the church. So we were sort of brought into this discussion to help SNAP figure out how do you get at the larger issues here and not just fight it in an individual sort of atomized case-by-case basis, because there is a larger system here. And I think certain aspects of international law speak to this and can come into play. What I would say about the new rules and these sort of periodic efforts by the church, attempts or appearances at addressing the issue, which fall so short, because you'll hear things like cardinals or even the Pope attempt to make apology, and it's basically they're saying they're sorry for what happened to these folks. They're not acknowledging that it didn't just happen. There were, you know, that there was responsibility and that should be shared throughout the church for allowing this atmosphere and this climate. You've seen, and I guess going back to 2001 or 2002, Barbara, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it was in the early 2000s where, there was an effort made to reorganize how the church was dealing with allegations of sexual abuse, and everything was supposed to be routed through to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, and that was headed by, at the time, Cardinal Ratzinger.
That's the old office of the Inquisition,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And that's right. In Rome, and that's where Ratzinger was, right?
Right. There are documents, letters, things coming out, you know, even after that attempt was made to ostensibly address what was happening, that really show, again, a lack of attention and a lack of awareness of the gravity of what's going on and a prioritization of the church protecting itself and its power rather than ensuring the protection of kids in the church and others in the church who are vulnerable to abuse by priests and others. And so this latest round of proposed rules, it looks like, another effort, to, again, sort of sidestep the core issue, which is accountability. The church has shown repeatedly it can't be trusted to police itself. And what it also looks like is an attempt to sort of decentralize now the responsibility. So it was centralized very clearly, and now it looks like an attempt to decentralize and sort of spread it out and get it away from Rome. One can assume a lot of things about that.
Can you explain procedurally how these cases are brought, where they're brought, and is there a possibility for, say, a large class action?
There have been a number of civil cases that are brought in the U.S., and they're brought under, tort law. Increasingly, we know of at least one or two cases that have been brought under the Alien Tort Statute, which allows non-citizens to use U.S. courts to do this. But in terms of getting at the bigger picture and framing it as a wider spread human rights violation, well, there are several key legal experts out there who have discussed this as a crime against humanity. And crimes against humanity, the hallmarks being that these are acts that are committed as part of a widespread or systematic assault or attack on a civilian population, and it fits. It's hard, I think, for some folks to get their mind around the Pope or others, high-ranking officials within the church as, perpetrators. But that's essentially, when you're talking about the massive sustained harm that is being caused here and the lack of awareness and acknowledgement of that gravity, it's really astonishing.
Pam, what would be the venue for a suit on a crime against humanity, and who would be the defendant?
Well, as far as venue, you've got a number of countries which have what is called a universal jurisdiction scheme. Spain is one, Germany is another, which allows them to prosecute crimes that are considered among the gravest and most serious of concern, serious war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. The International Criminal Court is another possible venue that has jurisdiction over crimes against humanity. And the issue here is when you have an institution like the Vatican, which has a global presence, the church has a global presence, and it's got varying political influence around the world, it's not beholden to anyone. It considers itself, the Holy See as its own state. And it has ratified conventions like the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but it can't be held accountable in the same way states are. There are no internal checks and balances. There's absolutely no way other than to go to these other fora to get your hands around the actual problem.
Barbara, I want to go back to you on the issue of what happens with complaints, either today or what's happened in the past. Let's say there's a current complaint. It's very hard to do, obviously, if it's a 12 or 13-year-old child. What happens when that complaint goes to the church, or what happens with some of your people for complaints that happened 20 or 30 years ago when they take it back to the church? Has there been a shift? Is it a significant shift? Is it just vary so much that it's hard to describe? Can you just give us some sense of that?
Well, I think, first of all, it's really important to recognize two things. Number one is that most child victims are not able to report until they are well into adulthood. So most of us didn't tell at the time when the abuse was happening, and we didn't tell before statutes of limitation ran out, which is for another whole discussion, but maybe why statutes of limitation should be eliminated the same way they are for murder and some other crimes. The other thing to recognize is that we as victims, for the most part, are devout Catholics, and it's really incredibly difficult for us to comprehend that someone in a position of authority in the church would not want us to be protected. Pam made a very important point when she talked about, in a sense, the enablers who allow these predators to not only abuse one or two children, but then transfer them where they can abuse more children. And so for us as a survivor movement, it was difficult for us to get our heads around and to comprehend that church officials understood and were well aware that the negative impact that sexual abuse causes upon a child. It was heartbreaking and devastating to learn that policy of the church officials is to protect the predators and their assets and their reputations, not the children. And that came out loud and clear in these reports that came out of Ireland, as well as, and by the way, that's only two reports out of Ireland, and from all of the United States, there are a total of six grand jury or attorney general reports of investigations into these crimes. By and large, PM is right. These church officials who have engaged in the cover-up and the enabling of the predators have not been held accountable. And somehow, it's a belief and a practice within the church that they are held above the law of the various nations where these crimes have occurred. They're accountable to no one, and that it's okay for them to continue to commit these crimes. And unfortunately, it's not just the church officials who act on this. I mean, right now in Germany, the government's investigating, and they've established what they're calling a round table to look into it. But they've invited the actual criminals, I would call them the criminals, although they don't see it this way, they've invited the bishops and the church officials to sit at the round table to help figure out the crimes. And in some ways, it's a little better in Belgium, but in Belgium, Parliament is now investigating or deciding what should be done.
Well, Belgium had that great raid, right? I mean, didn't they raid some?
Right, but apparently, it was determined to not be lawful.
Oh, they raided a bishop's house or something? I forgot. Archbishop's house?
They raided the bishop's conference of Belgium, where all the head bishops of the country were meeting. They actually held them for, it's reported 8 or 9 hours, and that they questioned them. They confiscated computers and cell phones and files and documents. You know, one court has already ruled in Belgium that none of that would be admissible for bringing charges. But the bottom line here is that we need to stop having church officials at all in the business of investigating crimes. And these criminals and the enablers, just the predators and the enablers, need to be held accountable in every country according to the civil laws, which obviously do not permit molesting and raping children.
Pam, let me ask you this. Cardinal Ratzinger, when he was head of the essentially Inquisition, has now ascended and is now the Pope. What do you see as his role in this and his eventual role as a defendant?
For instance, one could say in international criminal law there is superior responsibility anticipated in international criminal law for failing to take action to prevent crimes against humanity. And there's plenty to show that Ratzinger knew and actually intervened in specific cases to protect or delay processes with respect to individual priests. That's becoming more and more established through some of these cases. That's the way the international criminal legal approach is framed. But it's so ironic because there was news recently about the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops intervening again around birth control and trying to prevent birth control from being considered preventive care, which would enable women not to have to pay out of pocket for that. And there's just this preoccupation and obsession with controlling women's sexuality and the sexuality of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender folks, and the church has no attention to addressing its own. Right. So, the irony here is just, it is something, but again, I think it's been proven over and over that the church cannot be trusted to police itself, and it is skirting efforts for accountability.
Barbara, I have a question. Since founding SNAP, what would you say has been your proudest accomplishment, and in the road ahead, what is your greatest challenge?
Well, I think the biggest accomplishment is seeing survivors who have suffered for years, decades in secrecy and shame find their voice and speak up and just report the atrocities that they endured by being raped and assaulted by priests. And I suppose the biggest obstacle, I think, is fear that we as victims feel that we have not been able to report and name our predators. It's so incredibly painful and embarrassing and all the rest to tell about these crimes, but the vast majority of victims still do not report. I would say kind of a secondary issue is the fact that when Pam mentioned that many cases have been brought in the U.S., that's very true, but at the same time, the numbers of cases are very rare when you look at the full number of victims. By and large, most states in the U.S. prohibit us from bringing our lawsuits because by the time we're able to report our abuse, the statutes of limitation have run and we're prevented from having our day in court. In a sense, it's almost like a double whammy. It's heartbreaking and devastating that we aren't able to get our day in court, but it's more devastating to recognize that our perpetrators are then able to get away with the crime because they are empowered to remain out there. And most, as we know, do reoffend. Or they'll offend more children.
Barbara, you mentioned 10,000 survivors, which I know includes family and others. But you also said that it's a much vaster problem than that. So if you have any, give us some sense of how vast it is. But from listening to you and having spoken to you in the past, I wouldn't say that this happens routinely around the country, but I don't know what word I would really use. I mean, it's not rare, that's for sure. It's protected by the church, that's for sure. And I just think of myself, if I have a child, 10 or 11 or 12, and sending that child
off to be an altar boy or whatever else, I would be terrified. I would just be terrified. And just some response about that.
Well, I think the bishops themselves have conducted what they call a study, and we would refer to it as a self-survey, wherein they decided to engage the help of the John Jay College of Criminal Law and tried to come up with numbers of the of how many predators, how many victims, and that type of thing. And by their own numbers that they have made public, and this was on their website in various places, but they admit to approximately over 5,000 priests that they have identified are sexual offenders who have abused children between 1950 and maybe 2008.
And that's in the United States, is that right? In the United States, Barbara?
Right. And if you do the math and figure out, well, what percentage of priests are abusing children then, actually that's over 5%. It's about 5.2%. There have been a few places where there have been investigations by attorneys general and grand juries, places like where there's been a government investigation, the numbers of predators is much higher. It's up to between 8 and 10%, even 11% in one place. So if you think of the vast number of priests across the globe, and if you stick with the conservative numbers that the U.S. bishops, you know, concede, which is 5.2%, we're looking at a massive number of sexual predators across the globe. And by and large, for the most part, in the U.S., less than 2% of our predator priests were criminally indicted and convicted. It's less than that across the globe, where most probably are still in ministry today. So we're talking about a horrible problem. I mean, if the number of children who are being abused by the priests were coming down with polio, there would be a massive worldwide response to stop the outbreak of this horrible disease. And yet the abuse of children by priests does not generate that kind of a response. But it truly is horrific.
When you said 2%, I just want to clarify. If the John Jay study was 5%, it could be as high as 11%. When you said 2% were prosecuted, what you mean is 2% of the 5,000.
Less than 2% of the 5,000 that they are willing to admit to. We would suggest that there's many more predators that they're not admitting to because of all kinds of reasons. For example, they choose to not include priests who if victims reported prior to 2002. I don't believe we're included in the study, and I think the religious priests are excluded. So, meaning those who belong to a religious congregation, you know, like the Jesuits or the Dominicans or Franciscans, and those types are not included in these numbers. So we believe, and it's fair to say that those are extremely conservative, and out of those numbers, very few have been convicted.
What do you think the relationship is of celibacy to the general problem?
I would say that it may be a contributing factor to the culture of the secrecy and the silence, but I would not want to blame that on the or give that as an excuse for why these priests are doing this.
You say systemic. Why systemic? What is it that's causing this? You don't see this in other institutions, do you?
I would suggest that the Roman Catholic priests have this a belief and a commitment that once you're ordained a priest, you're a priest forever. And so I think that what happens is that that in other institutions and organizations, when someone rapes a child, they get fired. And in the church, they not only don't get fired, they frequently get promoted. But at a bare minimum, they remain in the ministry or they remain within the employment. And I think they get away with it or that it continues because they can, because no one's holding them accountable and stopping them. And anytime there's power that's unchecked, I think it expands and evil grows if it's permitted to.
That's right. And I think my comments go to that because in terms of this unchecked power and one of the things that happens or has traditionally happened when an incident is brought to the awareness of people within the church is that the walls close behind the people who are reporting it, the families who are reporting it or the parents. And what happens is they come within this veil of secrecy and confidentiality. They're locked into it at risk of excommunication. Victims and family members of victims are threatened with excommunication in a way that the abusers are not. Ever. I don't think we know of any instance where someone has been excommunicated for having committed these offenses. And the other thing is we often talk about it in terms of sexual abuse, and I think that that has a shape or a form when people think of it that is somehow separate or apart from sexual violence or rape. It's also, you know, sexual violence and rape have come to be known also as torture in international criminal law. I mean, these are very serious offenses. And, you know, as much as possible, when I'm talking about it, I'm trying to talk about it in terms of violence and less so about abuse. And the other thing about the unchecked power is that I think the church has always assumed it will always be this way, that it will always have exist above and beyond the law. And so what has happened is there is a paper trail because there are many documents they assumed would never see the light of day outside of its confines. And so there are actually, you know, rules about keeping safes in, you know, and lockboxes, and certain documents, certain types of documents go into those. The effort on the part of the Belgian law enforcement agents was key, but that needs to be happening everywhere. That the documents that really establish the knowledge and the offenses are, they actually exist. And just one more thing, I have to say that I was lucky enough to attend a conference that SNAP puts together, and it was one of the most moving events to see survivors of all ages coming together and in a space like that. And the feeling there was just really incredible because it is people who have had to work really hard to reclaim their lives. I think SNAP has done an incredible thing.
Well, thank you, Pam. And Barbara, you know, I want to, the little bit I've known you and the work of SNAP, I want to share what Pam has said. But I also want you to tell our listeners, I know SNAP has a website and how to get more material. What is your website, Barbara?
It's at snapnetwork.org.
Snapnetwork.org.
There's also a website that tracks a lot of this. It's called bishopaccountability.org.
When people are looking for action from the Pope, they should be looking for, not for lofty words, but action like the Pope opening up his files and turning them over to police and putting the names of the known predators on a website so that others will know to keep your children away from these guys.
Barbara, thank you.
Good to have you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.